point of crisis right now, where we have to actually understand where this crisis is coming from and how we're going to actually affect a change in the overall policy, not just in Canada, but in the world, and with the relation that we have with the different countries, which we're going to have to work with right now and figure out a way of on which kind of, what kind of basis we're going to actually work with them. So, okay, let's continue. So, economics, not shamanism. All right. That's a question that I asked different people yesterday when I was at the University of Montreal. There were a bunch of, you know, just economic economists talking together, and I would either say, you know, should we send your teacher to Auschwitz, or should we just burn down UDM, close it down because for incompetence? And of course, it stopped some people. They wanted to know what I was talking about. But we're going to talk about this idea of work and the value and what is an economy overall. And maybe we won't answer that question. You make your decision. But I can tell you that right now, the way that people are acting in the financial circles in the economic departments, I can tell you that if your teacher was asked if they would send you to Auschwitz, they would probably say yes. So we got to figure out why they're all wrong. Okay. So that's, these are excerpts from the debate that LaRouche had with this guy, Abel Lerner, this famous Keynesian economist from London. And we're going to read the excerpts. If I need two people, one Lerner and one LaRouche. Who wants to do it? One? So,
Okay. Because I agree with what was done in Brazil to check inflation, it doesn't mean that I'm in favor of the fascist dictatorship which they have there.
No longer is economics merely a plaything for an obscure corner of the academic priesthood. Now, economic policy is that which determines the lives and daily lives and conditions of people. The form of economic policy determines the kind of government which is necessary to carry it out. And the only kind of government which can carry out the kind of policy which Professor Lerner recommends would have to be a Bonapartist or fascist government. He may be opposed to fascism with every fiber of his being. This was also true in Germany, where many economists, liberal economists, proposed austerity, who also opposed the Nazi regime. But nonetheless, there are men who will take up these policies and carry them out. And they will be Bonapartists or fascists, but not Professor Lerner. So he must understand that sometimes his good intentions do not ensure that his policies carried into practice will work out as he sees them in human terms.
But if Germany had accepted Schock's policies, Hitler would not have been necessary.
Okay. That was the end of the debate. So who won?
LaRouche?
Huh?
LaRouche?
LaRouche? Yeah, why?
Because he's right.
Okay, we'll give it to you. No, well, but that wasn't the end. Well, I mean, it was the end, kind of, the debate. Because really, after that, you know, we didn't have to say anything. Like, the polemic that we had used at the time was that basically the policies of learner would lead to fascism. Basically, need they were Shakyan policies, but they were leading to fascism, as it was. And basically, what he was defending was the dictatorship in Brazil. So he said, "Well, I'm for the policies of Brazil, but you know, I'm not for the government of Brazil." So the way they run things, I don't necessarily like, but the policies are pretty good. And there's that's where the problem lies. That's where we have to actually reconnect, like, with reality right now, and see that the policies which the different economists, different government in the world have been applying, imposing in the past decades, have led us to this crisis. So whether they were socialist or just liberals. And the thing is that's only excerpts of the debate, but I thought that was the best one to actually show what was discussed, because the polemic was that Lerner, even if it was for government intervention, was the same kind of economist that was used at the time in Nazi Germany and in fascist Italy to actually promote cap on wages, promote the looting of the physical economy, and the destruction of labor unions. And basically right now, the thing is that, well, it's fine if people vote for it, right? If we vote for these policies, then it's our choice. That's what people will tell you at UDM, anyway. We have some people over there. Okay. So we're going to go through the myth of actually this idea of left and right, because that's a debate which we see all the time. Wherever we go, we get attacked by both. but really, the idea of these communists who are actually running UCAM, or, you know, the proto-fascists of the IEDM, the Institut Économique de Montréal at HEC, well, they all have the same idea of human beings. So that's their flaw. That's their problem. That's why actually they lead us, whether they're on the left or on the right, they lead us to a totalitarian system and fascism. So we're going to look at this myth of John Maynard Keynes also, who supposedly, you know, a good guy. Let's put it that way. That's what we're told. So, Schock, Keynes, and Hitler, buddies till the end. Who's this guy? What has he done? Well, we're going to look at his preface. 1937, he writes a book, his major book, The General Theory on the Value of Employment, Money, Interest, Everything. So, that's the copy, that's the translation of the German one, which he publishes in 1937. Mm-hmm. So, Rob, you want to read it? 1937. Or whoever. You raise your hand before.
Thus, I may perhaps expect to find less resistance among German readers than among English ones when I put before them a theory of employment and production as a whole, which differs in important respects from orthodox traditions. But can I hope to overcome Germany's economic agnosticism? Can I convince German economists that methods of formal analysis can make an important contribution to the analysis of present-day events and the formulation of present policies? After all, it belongs to the German character to be fascinated by theories. How hungry and thirsty must German economists be, having gone for so many years without theory? It is certainly worthwhile to me, or for me, to make an attempt. And if I can contribute some tidbits to a full meal, prepared and served by German economists and adapted to German conditions, then I will be content. For I must admit that much in the following book was written and illustrated in reference to the situation in Anglo-Saxon countries. Nevertheless, the theory of production as a whole, which is the object of this book, can be much better adapted to the conditions of a totalitarian state than the theory of production and distribution of wealth under circumstances of free competition and a large measure of laissez-faire.
Okay, so I've bolded some sections of it I thought were interesting to try to actually get at the crux of the argument, or why he's actually translating it in German so rapidly. So basically, what do you think he's saying, or what's the link between the German economy and Keynes at the time? It's 1937, right?
Yeah, so Hitler is there. Mm. Been there for 4 years or so.
Yeah. Maybe take some time to think about it. I think it's pretty clear, I don't know.
Interesting phrase. Contribute some tidbits to a full meal.
Yeah, yeah.
Does he care what tidbits he's contributing, or?
Or does he have an idea what the full meal actually is? Talking about Nazi Germany here.
Mm-hmm. Some sauerkraut.
What's good is that at the end, C. Stocking says my system would be better in a better adapted to a totalitarian state, but versus like free trade.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's like you don't have much of a choice, a dictator or
right.
Yeah. Cheap labor.
That's it. There's what he's offering is in a time of crisis or post-crisis, whatever time he's offering this in, is that under a state of a totalitarian state where nobody can really oppose what it is they're saying, then those are the conditions necessary for his system to be imposed. Nobody can say anything. So as long as his system can be imposed without any opposition, then it's fantastic. That's what it is. And that's kind of the notion that people have never really understood in terms of Keynesian economics, because that's what they offer you. It's either free reign economics where, mm-hmm. you know, huge major corporations pretty much dominate the scene, or you have exactly.
I think you got it backward. No. Free trade is about the individual. That's what controls the economy and the free trade. You said cartels and big corporations.
Oh, okay.
That's not it. No.
You just haven't.
You didn't have the class right.
Sorry. I didn't realize you were
doing
the
issues. Okay.
no, really, you did it well. So.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, we're you're right. Absolutely right, actually. Yeah, that's the only way that you can actually go with Keynes' policies, is that you have to actually have, well, no way of talking against it, no way of saying it's wrong. So you need a fascist government or a communist dictatorship.
So you just said free trade isn't pro-corporation?
No, that
was
a joke.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, you'll get to know me until the end of the class. let's see, because it's not the end. It goes on different topics. He's really a universal genius, this guy Keynes. So he's really talking about like the economy, but at large. So we're gonna. There's another quote which is quite interesting. Anybody wants to read it? Kevin first.
After 1870, there was developed on a large scale an unprecedented situation, and the economic condition of Europe became during the next 50 years unstable and peculiar. As numbers of population increased, food was actually easier to secure. Larger proportional returns from an increasing scale of production became true of agriculture as well as industry. That happy age lost sight of a view of the world which filled with deep-seated melancholy the founders of the British political economy. Before the 18th century, mankind entertained no false hopes to lay the illusions which grew popular at the ages lay their end. Malthus disclosed to the devil for half a century all serious economic writings held that devil in clear prospect. For the next half century, it was chained up and out of sight. Now perhaps we have loosed him again.
Is that clear? That's kind of... It is good, you know, he's a good speaker, he's like...
What he's saying is that after 1870, there's a process set in place that made food and goods cheaper and easier to acquire.
Right.
And that this made people lose sight of the real hardships of life, isn't it?
Yeah. That's... kind of what he's saying.
Yes.
But he makes it sound as though the type of process that makes food and goods cheap and available is actually a process of holding back a devil which always exists there.
Yeah, right. It's kind of an illusion. Like you can try to do that, but really you're only like, you know, you're only pushing it back. But it's going to get back to, it's like Arnie talking about the wolf. You know, the wolf that was tied and now it's loose again.
Is he talking about that?
Yeah, he's... yeah.
Oh, it's
in India.
Sorry.
I'm going to reference this firewall documentary that the youth, our basement crew has produced a documentary called Firewall. And if you want to have like a better sense of what I'm going through, that's one thing you should look at, look back at if you have seen it, or look at it for the first time, because it gives the whole historical perspective. We're going to go through that, but what you're saying is that, yeah, after 1870, basically industrialization was on. So we were developing ourselves, and the different countries were developing themselves.
And he calls that period of increasing prosperity unstable.
Yeah.
So you'd think a period where you have increasing food
supply
and resources per capita,
yeah,
increased industrial output per capita, a period of increasing stability.
Mm-hmm.
I would seem different. Or at least I would agree with that. Because what are the conditions under which that is occurring?
Yeah.
It's not
Luke?
It seems it's a pretty sad world to live without deep-seated melancholy. Melancholy? I mean,
mm-hmm.
The founders of the British political economy were lucky enough to have this deep-seated melancholy.
Yeah, well.
And then we couldn't have that once the Industrial Revolution started.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or we delude ourselves with, you know, fanciful ideas of
progress,
altruism,
generosity. But he's talking about the devil a lot. Devil and Malthus. Do people know either both or one? Because, they're interchangeable. But he really sums it up. Like, he says, like, you know, the British Empire, no longer after 1870, could rule the world the way it did before.
Mm-hmm.
One thing. Second thing, the natural resources, because you had nation states building up everywhere, were scarce for the British Empire. Okay. Now, that brings up Malthus, which is what was the chief economist of the Ellerbury School of Economics, if I remember well. I think it was that one. Who basically said that, yeah, there's going to be too many people on Earth at some point, and we're going to have to cut back on this, on the people. Because the food is not going to be able to sustain the population, and obviously we see it today. Because there's different food shortages around the world. Why is it would be a linear way of thinking about that if we just equate that situation in 1870 and right now. But we got to think about how this guy is thinking. We got to figure out, like, what's the purpose? Why is he writing that? Like, obviously he's not happy with the development after 1870. But he says that it's gonna get us back.
So there's something in the way he's talking here which sort of leads you to wonder, like what Rob pointed out, that he sees, you know, healthy industry, or at least industry that's capable of increasing food and
mm-hmm.
resources. He sees that as unstable and peculiar.
Right.
So I guess my question is, like, why? Why does he see it that way?
Well, the same reason that he's talking about Malthus.
But is he talking about Malthus in a... Does he like Malthus?
We're gonna see that just after, but yes, he likes Malthus. He believes Malthus is right, and that's the issue. He believes in entropy. That's what he believes in. That's his scientific outlook, if you can call it science, is entropy. Which is a fraud, which is the idea that basically you have a system, and the energy of the system, at some point, is just going to disappear. Like, you're going to burn it up. So basically, you won't have anything to... It's like, take it like a oven. Like, you're thinking back in 1870 with coal. Well, at some point, you're going to run out of coal. Okay, if the only combustible we had was coal, we're going to run out of it, and then the world is just going to shut down.
That's entropy.
Yeah.
The idea that things
slow down,
they decrease and...
So that's what you believe in.
Doesn't everyone believe that?
No. Not human beings.
Sure, you scientists believe that.
Yeah, but they're not really human beings these days. They're more computers than human beings. But it's okay, we're going to do something. We're going to try to save them from this devil that Malthus is talking about.
Yeah, because he says he was chained up during that time of progress and unstable progress. Now he says maybe we have loosed him up. We've loosed him again.
Yeah. He also said...
When is Keynes writing?
When? It's the beginning of the 20th century. He dies like a bit after the Second World War, 50s, around the 1950s. Maybe even before. But who is that guy? Well, Keynes is... an oligarch. He doesn't necessarily think like all the oligarchs, but he represents a faction of them. And the faction which is going to actually push the idea. Well, basically, all the oligarchs think in terms of money, or in terms of how we can control population and using a monetary system. And what he's going to bring in, which is revolutionary, it seems, is the idea of an intervention of the state in the economy. So basically printing money. The state is going to print money because, I mean, the bankers or the speculators, all these guys, they need money. They're not going to be producing it. It's going to be the state. But so far, that's what he's saying. Now, he's also a member of the Eugenic Society of England and of also the European Eugenics Council. So, yeah, he's a proponent of Malthusian type of economics and population control. So, like, there's something we're going to have to do about the population. We can print money as we want, but the population, gotta figure out a way to basically keep a certain level. And obviously, in Germany, they're doing it right.
Not only that, Pascal, he was vice president of the British Eugenics Society.
No, he was on the board. He was actually the finance. He was he was the finance guy.
That's appropriate.
Yeah. That's not really that important. He was a liberal, basically. That's what you got. He said after the Versailles Treaty in 1919, when basically the England had put like a big reparation, a big debt to Germany. He said, "Satan doesn't like the way you are going about this. You are creating too many problems for us in the future." That's what John Maynard Keynes says. That's his comments after the Versailles Treaty. Okay. I don't know who he says that to, but that's a quote which is pretty well known.
Can you read that again?
I could read it again. It's worth another look. Satan doesn't like the way you are going about this. You are creating too many problems for us in the future.
And for everyone else.
Yeah, well, but the idea is really, who's us?
Germany?
Well, John Maynard Keynes is an English guy. They said the way you're actually attacking, because it was an attack on Germany, the way you're imposing a debt on them that they will never be able to pay. And that's why people are saying, like, oh, you know, look, Keynes, he wasn't against the German. He said, like, he was against the Versailles Treaty. So, but that's only, like, that's a mild, it's not really true. The only thing is that he says, well, we haven't done it the right way.
He says Satan doesn't like.
Yeah, he said Satan. He's also, it was a member of this Cambridge Apostles.
Satan doesn't like the way you're doing this.
You're making problems
for us.
Kind of weird, huh?
Satan doesn't like it.
Yeah, well.
We'll talk to Satan.
And he was a Cambridge Apostle. It's where he studied some. It was a kind of a secret, but it's not really secret because everybody knows about it. But anyway, he was part of that. And a motto. They were kind of liberal. It's like think tanks. Like, we have think tanks today. They don't really hide themselves. But they're planning policies in our back. And just trying to get governments to apply them. Now, that's the same thing that Keynes was doing at the time. It's not really different. And basically, they had kind of mottos like, oh, you know, everything is permitted. The famous Nazi motto, alles ist erlaubt, all is permitted. And yeah, it's kind of weird that he talks about Satan. You know, it's kind of disturbing from a guy so well known. And
who does that?
It's John Maynard Keynes.
Talking about Satan?
Yeah. Somehow he has kind of a fascination with him. But
a lot?
The most important thing is about the problems that are created by the Versailles Treaty and the us, you know, the problem which are created for who. And he is basically representing a faction of the oligarchy, which is saying, well, it's going to be hard to actually, there's going to be a new war. There's no way that you can go about it without a new war. And that's where this quote after 1870 comes from also.
Why is that bad?
Why is that bad? You mean?
New war, the continent is not bad.
The Second World War? You mean?
Yeah,
well, I mean, these wars were just stupid. We didn't need these wars.
Yeah, but it doesn't affect a corporation, right? It's good for them, isn't it? You're selling products and you're rebuilding. Like, it's not, isn't that like a good thing?
Well, that's... Sorry, you said?
The people are dying. Like, they don't care.
Right.
Is.
Well, that's the question of the real economy, though. Are you actually sustain people and not kill them? That's what we're going to try to actually look at. But
oh, okay.
That's where Keynes was wrong, as the other liberals on the other side.
Yeah,
it's such a fine line.
Okay.
It's not a clear cut thing ever in history with what is motivating people or how they're thinking. So, you know, you can get these imperialists, liberal imperialists, who they might not like warfare and all kinds of people dying, but that doesn't mean that they're not imperialists.
Yeah, right. They're going to have different ways of going about it.
Yeah, so, but also, it's important to keep in mind that, you know, Britain almost lost World War I.
Yeah.
I mean, they were only saved because of the backing of U.S. banking and the U.S. eventually coming into the war. Otherwise, Germany would have defeated all of the Allies. You know, so, a lot of people looking at that would have said, well, geez, we're going to impose something on them that's going to bring about another war with Germany within a generation. I mean, it's like today. I mean, there are people in Britain that we know who have no. They're part of the British oligarchy, but that doesn't mean that they want a new global war because they want to have something to rule.
Right.
You know, but they have. It's not an issue of. You know, them thinking that human beings aren't their cattle to control. They just want to have something that's a lack of control.
That brings me to a guy which name is Paolo Sarpi. And basically, if you want to understand the way that actually even the oligarchs fight each other, you have to go back at this guy, which actually created this kind of, the term, well, liberalism, how we actually look at the way it's used by the oligarchs, because that's where it comes from. This idea of basically, you can't really know truth. We can fight over things, but really at the end you won't know. There's no way of actually knowing. And that's how basically at some point in the different empires, and you had the Venetian Empire, the British Empire. At the time of the Venetian Empire, you had a fight in the oligarchy between the old Venetian families and the new ones, because you had some kind of advancement, like new families were getting in the oligarchy. It was a tight circle, but some new were accepted sometimes. And so at some point, they had a fight, and the new Venetian won and said, well, we're going to allow... Since the way the nation states are developing around Europe, we're going to have to accept to develop ourselves too. We can't just stay backward and be defeated. Yeah. So we go, okay, we're going to, you know, go against our principles, but it's for a good purpose, because we want to rule the world. So that's what the new Venetians said. You know, we're going to actually... go with science, but so, you know, as far as like we're gonna teach the formulas to people, but they won't know where it comes from. They won't know how to figure it out by themselves. So this way we're gonna be prevented from having like some genius and, you know, like Kepler and all these guys like breaking our rules, because we want to get, you know, a fixed system. There's not enough resources, you gotta rule the world, you gotta keep people straight. So that's where kind of where Keynes comes from. But the other branch also of free trade liberals are also coming from these this Venetian tradition. So it's the same, there's the same kind of ideology, same view of human beings. Have to be controlled by some rule, and on one side they're going to say, well, it's a free market, and on the other side they're going to say it's, we need intervention by the state. But it's completely the idea is to destroy the nation state, is to actually still keep the empire going. So there's more quotes more quotes by Keynes, where he talks about eugenics, talks about sociology, but really eugenics. You want to read that one? That one. It's kind of got to be.
Keynesian economics and eugenics. I do not depart from the old Malthusian conclusion. I possessed all Francis Galton's books whilst I was still an undergraduate. The Malthusian theory was that more capital resources per head, chiefly in the shape of land, must be of immense benefit to the standard of life, and that the growth of the population was disastrous to human standards by retarding this increase.
Mm-hmm. That was published in the Eugenics Review. The main part.
Eugenics and sociology.
We'll discuss these after.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Eugenics and sociology. The founder of the most important, significant, and I would add, genuine branch of sociology, which exists, namely eugenics, is Galton's worthy and distinguished disciple, Carr Saunders. Problems of Population. Essentially approached through the biological background of man, and not principally through the economic approach.
So that's, I think it's pretty telling of the guy. You wanted to discuss something, Rob?
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating. This,
well, not that much.
Service quote. So
yeah.
Now by the...
Can we read it?
Yeah. Keynesian economics and eugenics. I do not depart from the old Malthusian conclusion. I possessed all of Francis Galton's books whilst I was still an undergraduate. The Malthusian theory was that more capital resources per head, chiefly in the shape of land, must be of immense benefit to the standard of life, and that the growth of population was disastrous to human standards by retarding this increase.
Hmm. Yeah.
So the optimal standard of living that could be achieved by human society would be achieved when there was one guy left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ruler of the world.
I guess that
the king of
Hobbes.
The mountain.
Hobbesian.
Huh?
Isn't that a Hobbesian point of view where you're fighting everybody else?
Adam and Eve
yeah.
had a man.
To survive?
Yeah. Man,
they
did.
Well,
Adam
did.
Let's take
yeah.
a
yeah. Before he got rid of his, and stole his rib. Man.
He didn't say that.
Okay.
It just says that if you have more land, you have more resources per individual. But I'm not saying that. You're just saying more capital resources per head must be of immense benefit to the standard of life, and that
the growth
that
of
that
population
that
is disastrous.
Yeah. Yeah, no, yeah, but he's not saying like
so
I don't know. I'm not saying the one man on the world thing. I'm just saying that if you have like the sense that like the more like if you have less people, you have more resources per individual. So
right.
Isn't that all he's saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Which is
yeah
odd,
that's
like
what you're saying.
Obvious
yeah, yeah,
but yeah it's pretty obvious, but...
Consequences in the long term.
Because yeah. this applies if you're thinking about... Like, close your eyes and you reread it, think about a herd, like, cattle. It works pretty well as a statement, I guess. Yeah, those cows will do pretty well at a certain level of population. But if you start adding cattle, they're not going to...
Mm-hmm.
Something else is going to happen. They'll have less to eat.
Go on.
Yeah. I was just going to say, what he's saying is true among animal populations. Right? But.
And we don't take animal resources? Like, we don't need resources as well as animals?
Well, we're not animals.
Yeah, but we require the same resources, don't
right.
we?
But the thing is that
we're
we can actually produce
anything.
More.
What?
What he leaves out of the equation is that as human beings, We are the only species on Earth that actually can increase
productivity. Yeah.
Well, the volume of of
resources.
Goods
well,
and
we
resources
still
and create new ones.
We're still limited to what we have.
Well, obviously there are some boundary
generator or something where you're like popping like coffee out of nothing.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that you can actually, and we're gonna have an exercise on that, but you can actually understand the way that the universe works. You can understand different principles which are acting on you and acting universally. And by actually understanding that, you are increasing your power in the universe. And if you think about the economy, that's the idea of how you actually sustain a population which is growing, and how also the development of new technology is going to help you out, develop more brains, more people, because that's actually what we can do differently than animals. We can actually improve the status of the Earth by sustaining more people. It requires something from us that we have to achieve if we want to be able to keep a population of 6.5 billion and more.
Yeah.
That's what he leaves out of the equation.
That's right. He's leaving the actual productivity out of the equation.
Or
the
creativity.
Jinx.
Creativity and productivity. He's saying,
right.
He's saying the standard of living is,
right.
is inversely proportional to the number of people based on the amount of resources. He doesn't take into account that people actually discover and and create resources.
Yeah.
You know, like oil, for instance, is not a resource in and of itself until you apply an understanding principle to use it as a fuel. Before it was a poison on the land. You know, when you find oil on your land, it's really it's poison if you're a farmer, let's say. Then you discover you can burn it, and it's an effective fuel that it's many times more efficient than coal. Then all of a sudden it becomes a resource. You know, shifting mode of production, you're no longer hammering on coal or trees, you're now onto oil.
So you're making the assumption then that every time we reach a population density maximum, we can discover, assuming that we can, some new method of. That's
yeah. Assuming that we can. Yeah.
And if you don't, then you just
then
use everything
you like to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then we
have when you stop actually trying to find a way, a better way of doing things, then you're gonna have some problems. You're gonna have the devil, you know, Malthus's devil, which is gonna run at you and eat you.
When you start assuming
that
you can't.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. If you find the thing.
When you assume you can't.
If you're assuming that, let's say, you're not.
Well, there's parts of the world right now that
I
can't.
Sure.
Yeah, but we can't.
Well, in Canada, we're living well, but like you said, in parts of India and China where they're starving to death, it's because the other population is too much, they don't even have enough food to feed them.
But think of it as a development of humanity as a whole. Like since we have it here,
we
have to actually use it to help other people with that knowledge. Like overall, humanity has knowledge, so we have to apply it. That's where we're lacking some understanding today.
Okay.
But if you think about that, they don't have it, but some place else we have it. We know we could use it and actually benefit everybody with that. But let's go back to this. the question?
I just wanted to add something. In terms of, for me, the easiest way of explaining is just looking at farming, right? The way he's looking at it is that all humans are chipmunks, and that we can only survive depending on how many nuts we can carry. But the thing is, humans can farm. And over the centuries, we've developed farming to such a point where we can sustain the level of our population as it increases. Now, the problem with China and India isn't the fact that they have too many people. It's the fact that they don't have enough of a agricultural productivity to sustain their growing population. Same thing in Africa. If they had the productivity, the capacity to produce that food, then they would be able to feed their people, but they don't. And that's really is at the source of the issue. You kill them and let them die because, we're not helping them help themselves, you know, just like This is the way we're looking at it. This is the way we've dealt with the problem. Let's give them all fish. Let's cut them checks. Let's throw them rice from a plane instead of showing them how to fish, which is what? Showing them and giving them the ability to help themselves, which is have their own productive capacity. That's what it is. If you look at human beings as chipmunks, yeah, okay, there's a problem. If you look at human beings as human beings, then there's a difference.
But at the same time, like, the factories we've put there destroyed, like, their land and water and, like, killed their fish. So while we're growing, we're also destroying and we're causing more problems.
Yeah, but we're not growing anything today. The society you're seeing is failing,
mm-hmm.
even here. So we're not growing much there, that's for sure.
I was just having this conversation with my friend's mom yesterday. Nobody's defending polluting and industries that aren't regulated. That's really at the source here, is industries that are not regulated and don't have to apply any kind of technological innovation. You look at major corporations, okay? They don't have... This is the idea of globalization, where you have centralized and concentrated power. So corporations get big and get powerful not by innovating, not by using the creative capacity of the mind. What they do is that they take their concentrated power and buy out other companies. That's globalization.
Mm-hmm.
That's called imperialism. Where instead of going in, killing people, and taking what they own, you just take the more money that you have and you buy them out. That's what it is. Now, big corporations don't spend their money on innovation and increasing the productive capacity. They spend their money on buying other people out, which is what? Which is getting rid of your competition. Which is why we're at the position where we are today. It has nothing to do with our industry or the way we live. It has to do with the powers that be and what they do with their money and how they stay in power.
Hmm.
That's what they were about.
See, it's the same thing. They really didn't get free trade. They didn't get it. Get rid of competition. Come on. But that, yeah, we got to look at that closely. But it's also the same idea there that you have with the central banking system, because that's what is ruling the economy right now. It's a concept which actually comes from that time, you know, the after 1870, and I mean, it just, yeah, you know, I got that. I was researching it, then I found the funniest was from Wikipedia, of course, but I just wanted to read it so that we could get a good laugh. But
this is all from
at the same time think. Yeah, it's all from Wikipedia. I was searching for a definition, you know, and that's what Wikipedia offers people. So, can somebody read that one? Who hasn't read?
Most. Okay, I'll read.
Okay.
Most countries today have in
richer.
What?
It's rich.
Oh yeah, right. Maybe I shouldn't read. Okay. Most richer countries today have an independent central bank. That is, one which operates under rules designed to prevent political interference. Examples include the Bank of England, the Netherlands, the Banco Central de Chile, the Reserve Bank of Australia, the Reserve Bank of India, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Canada, the Banco de la República de Colombia, Central Bank of Norway, State Bank of Pakistan, and U.S. Federal Reserve. Some central banks are publicly owned, and others are, in theory, privately owned.
Note, I have...
Which
it's
one?
It's all my emphasis. It's not that.
So you underline everything, eh?
Yeah, it's my emphasis. It's not that.
Okay.
But I thought it was pretty funny. I had a good laugh when I read that.
Hmm.
I wanted to partake. Because that's how the economy is being run right now. That's why it's actually failing. It's because they have decided to be independent from reality. They said, like, hey, we're just going to print money. Whatever goes, you know? And it's really the way it goes today. That's how they bail out Bear Stearns. That's how they rule the economy. So, but they say, yeah, without... It's designed so that any kind of political, government, whoever has been elected... cannot interfere with the policy of the bank. And they say, you know, it's only in theory private. It's not, you know, in practice. It's it's owned by some public entity, which is a
shareholders.
Yeah, sure. much more shareholders than anything else. But we see that all these banks, and that's kind of major banks. They didn't state all of them, but these are the major ones. And so that's the way Keynes was looking at the economy. That's how also, because LaRouche was asked that question in the webcast on the March 12th webcast. It was asked, well, what's the difference between Keynes and, because, you know, you have this guy, Roehatten, who says he's a Roosevelt, a New Dealer kind of guy. But what's the difference between Keynes and Roosevelt and Roehatten and all that? And LaRouche said it's just people don't understand their history. A central bank is not, it's always bad. It's always the way that the empire have been ruling the economy. And that's how they take control of other nation states. That's how they actually apply, and you look at the European Central Bank. That's what they're doing with the Lisbon Treaty. They're saying, you know, we're gonna have a super parliament where basically you'll do your rules, you'll vote your laws, but we're gonna have the bank apart, and we're gonna give you the money so you can actually do whatever you want. But really, it's only if we want to give you the money at the end. So that's the idea of a central bank. It's not going to be, these guys are not going to be voted for. But that's how Keynes was looking at the thing. And we're going to look at the other side also. What are the two conflicting ideas, which really are the false debate between the two sides of the oligarchy? The free market, which sets the price, or the oligarchy, which rules the central bank. Because
what do you call a bank that is state owned?
A national bank. A real national bank is going to be totally owned by the government. Not just partially or in theory, but totally owned by the government. That's the basis of the American system. So basically, yeah, you have these fellows which we're trying to debate also on this question of who's going to issue the money. We should have the money. How should we deal with the economy? How should it work? And so Milton Friedman is pretty interesting because he also talks about Nazi Germany like Keynes. So we're going to see if he talks about it the same way.
The objective of such control is the restriction of spending on the part of the individuals, so that individuals' spending will increase less rapidly than the quantity of money. Such a policy, if rigorously enforced, should restrain a rise in the price level. As indicated earlier, this policy appears to have been successful in Nazi Germany. I'm going to read again. The objective of such control is the restriction of spending on the part of the individuals, so that individuals' spending will increase less rapidly than the quantity of money.
And
that should restrain the price level. So to combat inflation.
Right, that's what he's talking about. He says we got to stop inflation, so therefore we're going to try to restrict the individual. Which is kind of a big stretch, because he's a free marketeer. So he's like, the individual, it's free trade. Free trade. but he's saying, like, we're going to have to actually restrict people.
Question.
Yeah.
Is Milton Friedman seen as the opposer to Keynes?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yeah. Not for government.
This was his very famous book. I think this is the work that won him the Nobel Prize.
I think so too.
On his quantity theory of money or something like that.
So he's not Canadian?
No.
He comes from the Chicago
School of Economics. He's a free trade.
But he comes from Adam Smith, right?
Yeah.
So laissez-faire.
Yeah, right.
But what's the difference?
What's the difference? Well, the difference is there's no difference.
I thought so.
Because basically he said, well, look at the, you know, the quote from Keynes. He said, like, Nazi Germany is the best economy, best system you could have to actually impose my policies. My theory on employment and value and money and whatever would be applied the best in Nazi Germany, in a totalitarian state. Now, Milton Friedman says, well, we're going to have to restrict people and impose cap on their wages and, you know, stop inflation and blah, blah, blah. And the way we're going to do that, well, it worked in Nazi Germany. That's how, you know.
That's all I
got to
say, and I don't want to know anything else.
Yeah, so what's the difference, really? What are they saying different? Well, one talks about the individual and the other one talks about the state. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference.
One has no hair and the other.
The second difference.
Sorry.
I think he's shorter too.
But
in both cases, the actions of those individuals, or the actions of, because they both talk about individuals, and in Keynes it was, you know, less individuals, more resources per head kind of thing. That's what he said.
Yeah. Right.
And yet made no reference to the type of activities that those people could be engaged in to increase their level of their level of living. And in this one it's a similar thing. You have a sense that there's no idea that sort of injects this. Where does the wealth actually come from? What's the money based upon?
Yeah, but that's not the issue.
No.
It's how we're going to actually exchange the money. That's the issue. Who's going to give
money
me the money so I can exchange it? They're missing some parts. I mean, there's no way if you read them that they're going to actually tell you how money is created. It's not really the idea. Let me check a bit. Oh yeah, here. I was looking at different things. I was trying to see what's the difference really. You have on one side these guys, kind of liberals like von Hayek and Milton Friedman. These guys like big proponent of free trade economics, so individualistic type of policies. Basically, they say that's another quote. Milton Friedman says, it was in a documentary where you see the water, you see Chicago, because he was teaching at the Chicago University, and you see the water, all the waves going, you know, on the Chicago shore. He says the market force are like a big wave that you have to harness. That's how the market works. And if you actually understand the rules of the market, you can actually become a master of it and sell your stuff the best way. You're going to be the best. You know, you got to be the best, otherwise you get drowned in the wave. So it's the individual has to figure out the rules of the universe, of the waves, of the market. Kind of the trend, how you can actually get people to buy your stuff. So innovation. And on the other side, you see the kind of system which Keynes was advocating was kind of, well, we're going to put, we have different formulas. We need money for this, for that. We're going to just like put the, you know, the money in the equation. And, you know, it's going to be a rational way of splitting the money. And the state is going to furnish us. You know, if we need money, just throw it. Throw it in the equation, and it's going to go everywhere. And that's going to stimulate people. That's going to stimulate work. People will not be unemployed. And we're going to, everything's going to be stable. So it's a kind of more computerized type. It's not so much, you know, the instinct and the wave, the power of nature. It's more rational, more, you know, mechanical. Let's say mechanical.
Do you know when in what he said that? It's in this one of the books he wrote.
This one.
Mm-hmm.
I could find it. Not too sure when. In the 1970s, I think.
Something like the quantum theory of mind.
Yeah.
It's very.
Yeah. Okay. So another free trader. He was at the time of Keynes, but he was not that famous. Keynes like took the whole stage for him. Didn't let any competition. Yeah. So, and Hayek became more. Well known afterward when Keynes' influence began to slow down and fade away. And then we went back with free trade. And so, they knew each other, and Hayek, you'll see, basically, that's his opinion. Keynes, after reading Hayek's book, says, like, it's a great book. That's like, it's wonderful. That's exactly it. In my opinion, it is a grand book. Morally and philosophically, I find myself in agreement with virtually the whole of it. And not only in agreement with it, but in deeply moved agreement. So,
after reading which book, sir?
The Road to Serfdom by Hayek. The Road to Serfdom was basically, well, you know, we need free trade. Like, it's an attack on communism, in a sense. Saying, like, well, communism, it's not going to work. The idea of intervention is not going to work. If we try to plan everything, it's not going to work. It's going to bring us back to fascism, totalitarianism. And so Keynes says, yeah, I agree.
I thought Keynes was against this whole free trade.
Of course.
Free market.
Yeah.
But he agrees with Hayek, who's for free trade.
Morally and philosophically.
But not in which way?
But not... He's it's really a big play on the word. Like, they agree with each other on everything.
Yeah.
But on this question of who's going to give you the money. It's really it. It's not really... it's a big fight on words, but really, it's not at the end. When you actually look at both, you see that they basically have the same policy. They're going to bring you at the same point. So it's really a major fraud. But that's what's taught right now in university. Because that was the opinion of Hayek. The idea he says, that's my fundamental conception at the end. He says, we will benefit our fellow men the most if we are guided solely by the striving for gain. For this purpose, we have to return to an automatic system, which brings us about self-directing automatic system, which alone can restore liberty and prosperity. That is my fundamental conception.
When he says self-directing automatic system, it's like,
each individual,
the free market.
What's the invisible hand?
The free market. market.
Yeah. But he's talking about the individual, and Keynes talks about a system.
Was that Hayek's quote down below?
Yeah.
Yep.
In an interview.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, actually, you can actually see him say that. Pretty Leon.
Does he drool?
No. Come on.
It seems like a friendly old lamp.
Yeah.
Cheap shot. So this is kind of contradictory then of Keynes to.
Yeah, big time.
To be into this.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
some
it is, but it's not.
No, because like there's the two sides, right? There's Keynes, which. What's he for? Control by the state?
Well, he is for the idea of actually having the money being printed, like having an intervention by the state to print the money. But really the idea is that you have an oligarchy which is fighting over, well, how are we going to control people? Can we allow people to actually vote for somebody? Can we allow democracy, or how do we rule the state? And this idea is like, well, in the fascist state, you know, this idea of corporatism is that the companies are going to rule society. It's going to be the corporate structure, but unifying, like they say, you know, we're going to. That's why fascism is the idea of unifying, like the family, the corporate, the government, everything together, you know, well bounded. But the thing is, well, at this point, when the companies which are owned by these old families, you know, when you talk about the oligarchy, these guys are going to actually put their friends in the government. They're going to say, well, you know, here's your job. So basically, the economy is going to be run from these companies, and they're going to put their friend in the government, so that they continue the policies which are good for the companies. On the other side, in the communist society, well, you're going to have the idea that the state will run all the companies. So the people in the state, well, the oligarchy which controlled people in the state, actually put their friends at the head of the companies. Yeah, that's the idea. So it's the complete opposite, but at the same time, it's the same. Because the control is actually exerted from the oligarchy. So it's not really an issue of money. And that's the problem with the fight between these guys. They're fighting over money or over, like, kind of policies. Who's going to impose these policies? And that's not really the issue. I don't know.
I just look at the central banks as really, they're conceived as the lender of last resort. So they're supposed to bail out the companies when they need money. So in terms of, I mean, in reality, Keynes and Friedman were friends. They might have opposed each other ideologically, or so it seemed on some points, but they were friends. And I really think the idea of introducing these two ideas is where you, and we're seeing it right now. It's funny that we're living in it right now, that you have Friedman's system, which completely loots the system, destroys it, and then you have Keynes' system that steps in and sort of cleans up the mess. So the central banks sort of bail everything out, the state comes in, takes control of everything, and of course Keynes has to bring in a dictator. So a dictator and Keynesian economics come in and sort of clean up the mess that was left behind by Friedman and his gallivanting economic friends, I guess. Maybe that's what it is. It's a ping pong relationship where they sort of keep the power there. They keep the status there. Nothing really changes, and that's how they keep it going.
Pretty much, yeah.
Just like we're seeing now, all these wild-eyed free traders calling for a government bailout.
Help me. Yeah.
To save the poor, as John Oldfield said, right? To save the poor, victimized banks. Taking advantage of by unscrupulous, you know, subprime lenders and greedy homeowners.
Damn poor people.
It's always the poor people.
That'll teach you about my homes.
Taking our jobs.
I just got rid of the poor people.
Well, they're just useless eaters,
yeah, well,
right?
Victimized.
Mm.
Well, it's because we don't really have the resources, remember?
Right.
At the end, how it goes. But so, but they have the magic solution, as you said. It's interesting how it's. Yeah. Who was first? Okay.
What does it mean by striking for gain?
Striking for, well, personal gain, money, like how to acquire wealth. This essentially is in money, in terms of money.
Okay. And if we do it in an organic system, then technically we're no more dependent on the oligarchy?
No, because the automatic system is planned by the oligarchy for you.
Okay. Then what if the population organize an automatic system?
Well, we have to break the rules of the system overall. That's the thing.
And I guess if we can bypass the oligarchy system.
Yeah, can destroy the oligarchy, yeah. That's what we have to do. Because if we just follow on what they have planned, well, right now, that's the situation we see overall. Oh, yeah, the question, sorry. What's your name?
You're still answering his question now, aren't you? I'm Jeremy, sorry.
Jeremy, yeah. That's what we have to do, in a sense. We can't just go with an automatic system because that's what it leads us to. This idea. It doesn't work. Like all their theory is leading us to the crash right now. So that's not the.
It goes back
no
to this idea of entropy too, or the fixed system.
Right.
That the universe is generally fixed, and so you can just have an automatic system and give it a little shove, and that's all you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just cruise control.
Cruise control.
In the wall. But did you have a question?
Yeah, so we basically established that, like, free market economy, not great, fascist, socialist, structured economy, not great. I'm having a hard time understanding, like, the middle point that you guys are trying to profess. Like, I understand that you can't have both extremes, but I also have a hard time understanding how people who are basically, small amount of people who are basically controlling everything are going to be overthrown if they have their fingers in everything.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially even this organization.
Well, we're going to show you how we actually detect these guys. Maybe we should do it right now. Everybody is going
to...
Everybody should take a piece of paper right now.
Everybody's going to leave all paranoid.
We're gonna have to have like magnet, like detector.
You have a piece of paper, pen. Okay.
Paper.
We're gonna have some fun. We're gonna detect the oligarchs. We're gonna pass it as a piece of paper.
Anyone whose name is the second or the third, get out of here. Answorth.
That sounds like a very oligarchic thing to say.
Yeah. JP, you're out.
Give the test. See if I'm the real one.
So I'll just give the challenge. Yeah. And if you have already done it, then I'm going to give you another one. But it's called the doubling of the square. So you have to basically just trace a square. Just make a square on your your piece of paper. And without a ruler, but even with a ruler, you couldn't, but without a ruler, you're going to double the surface of this square. For those who actually have done it, I'm going to give you another challenge. I'm going to actually prove the Pythagorean theorem for those who haven't done it yet.
What do you mean doubled?
You're going to double the surface, like the area of the square. From that one, you're going to actually create a doubly, a square which is double the area. Ilko, you're right on time.
What's the next challenge?
You're proving the Pythagorean? Okay. You're gonna
make
a challenge. You have a challenge? Because I'm gonna do it too. I'm gonna try. If you have another challenge.
Well,
I thought about. Oh, wait, so yeah. Well, let's try to see. I didn't really have many challenges tonight. I thought that would be fun.
That's
that
your
would be fine.
Well, prove an algebraic formula.
Aren't there like 80 ways to prove the Pythagorean theorem? Like,
yes.
Couldn't you just?
Yeah, many ways.
Even
yeah.
When you try it, you're proving it one way. Try one the other 7. Yeah.
Well, you gotta do it, though. Okay, yeah, try another one. Try to find it another way.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That's interesting. Thanks, Matt. That's out of the box.
Well, there's also the challenge of trying to double a triangle.
Oh.
That one's really annoying.
Doubling a triangle?
Just make a square.
Huh?
Just make a square.
Like whatever triangle?
I can't do it yet.
Double what? You mean double the area? It's still a triangle of the same.
Yeah, it's got to be the same triangle.
If it's
oh,
a rect,
because
then you could just say, well, double the height or something, double the base.
Well, then just multiply it by 1.5.
Have you doubled the square?
Yeah, well, I tried.
Okay.
Is he an oligarch, Pascal?
Nope. Okay, bad. You gotta explain to me what you did.
Or what we could do is
double the triangle.
We could. If you want to get the board,
oh yeah, okay.
And someone could, we could do.
We could try it, yeah. Try it by. Okay,
the
yeah.
The ball any triangle. It's interesting.
Can I erase what's on the board?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's totally not important.
I think it's easier if you start with the equal sign.
Yeah. Trying to put some rules there, huh? Make it easier. Okay. For those who are doing the squares. A nice square. Kind of.
Oh boy.
Qu'est-ce que tu as fait?
J'ai acheté 4 sur les côtés. Et comme ça, c'est un 1 cm cube. C'est 4 cm cube. Et tu es rendu avec l'autre.
Ouais. Ben attends, comment tu calcules là?
Ben tu regardes, pas cube carré.
Mm-hmm.
Si t'en as 4.
Ouais, ouais.
Mais si t'en as 8. Si t'en as 2.
Oh, j'avoue que s'ils étaient toutes la même forme, ce serait
c'est
ce
ça,
serait
ça,
double.
Si j'avais une règle, ça aurait été.
Ouais, mais c'est ça le défi, genre. C'est à savoir comment à partir de ça, comment à partir de ces éléments-là, parce que t'as pas de règle, c'est un peu plus difficile, mais en même temps,
ouais,
bah, c'est un principe qui existe dans le carré, qui peut t'amener là directement, en fait, sans que t'aies besoin de mesurer quoi que ce soit. C'est ça qui est... C'est ça qui est le défi en fait. De voir
qu'est-ce que c'est le carré,
tu peux y aller. Oui, oui. C'est parce que ça pourrait être vrai, sauf que il faudrait que tu sois capable en fait de le faire pareil. Mais l'idée c'est check. 2 par 2, ok, ça serait l'arbre de ton carré. Ou en fait, ça c'est 1. Dans le fond, ce que ça fait, c'est de rajouter la demi ici. Là, ça fait 1/2 par 1/2. Ouais.
Mm-hmm.
Ok. Mais 1/2 par 1/2, est-ce que ça te donne 2?
Mm. Ok. La question, c'est.
Je
sais pas si ça,
ça
il
faut la
patente.
C'est un essai. C'est un essai. Mais là, c'est ça. Ça.
Tu veux 2? Tu veux pas.
Ouais, je veux que
ça c'est une carré.
Ça
pourrait
pas,
ça
irait pas.
Inquiète,
c'est un c'est
je commence à vous mettre comme ça.
Il faut trouver dans le fond la mesure du côté
non, mais
qui va t'amener, tu le côté de ton carré de 2. C'est ça qu'il faut comprendre. Comment on produit ça?
Bon, carré.
Okay. Je vais penser à. Qu'est-ce qui au carré va te donner 2?
Je fais.
Mais je sais pas, bonne chance. Si tu peux me prouver pour un 2, ça serait bien dans un sens, sauf que.
Non,
en fait, c'est,
non,
ça
c'est
pas
ça
en fait. Ça marcherait pas. C'est une carrière.
Ça, c'est une carrière.
Mais.
Tu as 7 points ici. Ça, c'est une autre.
Non, il y a une longueur qui existe et qui va te donner 2. Mais c'est pas une longueur qui est linéaire en tant que telle. Ce que je veux dire, c'est ce ne sera pas une simple extension d'un côté de ton carré qui va t'amener au double.
Did you double it?
Ça va être. Il va falloir que
tu prouves. Can you prove it?
Ouais, genre, une autre forme de. De ligne, si tu veux. C'est plus la nature de la ligne, différente, mais je veux pas trop te mélanger avec ça, mais juste une ligne, mais qui n'est pas le côté. C'est pas juste une extension de ton côté. Ouais, c'est d'autres choses.
Are you able to prove that your new square is double the size of your first?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I got it when I graduated. Fait que, essaie d'autres choses en fait. Si tu n'as pas eu le premier fois, c'est pas vrai. L'idée, c'est pas de la. C'est de pas lâcher.
Okay, well, you have a center square and then you just make sort of a bigger square over it. Basically. This triangle is the same. Okay. You have this one. Ask your teacher. Double it, just regular. Yeah. Basically. Okay. And if you look at it, they would just tell you, like, you have, like, individual squares in here to each of the same.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Oh,
so this one is the Where's it to?
Oh, wait, okay. I'll reiterate it. Hope you had fun. Okay, everybody. Oh, I'm back.
Where are you?
I'm back. Ah. Okay, so I hope we made some discoveries.
Yes.
And that was the reason of... Okay, you made some discoveries. What have you discovered?
He discovered a new method to make
the
square free.
Make the square? Okay.
Square
free.
Okay, cool. All right. Any other discoveries?
We have five. We need to make a nice. I think it's correct that we have to put
okay. All right, well. So this idea of actually developing a method to discover something, to discover, let's say, like in the question of the doubling of the square, you actually discover it, and we were discussing, Greg and I, over this, what is the length of the diagonal? Is it 2? Is it 1.5? Is it, what is it? How do you figure it out? But the idea is that you're always going to have to use that if you want to double the square. There's something that you figured out, which is in the square, is going to, if you want to double it, is always going to come back. And so we were discussing the nature of the diagonal. But anyway, that I don't want to extend too much, but that's something interesting too. And that's a problem between these two schools, you know, the Keynes, these two side, the Keynesian and the Milton Friedmans, or whatever you want to call them, is that they don't actually look at these idea of the nature of human beings, but the idea of how actually you increase your potential, you increase your power in the universe to actually create more wealth. And so right now we're at this point where they're creating more money, but they're not creating more wealth. So their solution right now is to print. And that leads us to basically a critical point where right now you have, and you see it with Bear Stearns, it's crashing right now. You see it happening, and LaRouche had forecasted it a long time ago, 40 years ago. So he knew it would happen because he could actually see the kind of trend that these guys had adopted in the way that they were dealing with the economy, the way that they were dealing with human development. They were going at it really in a linear way, which, if you do that, you won't double the square. Tried with Kevin. It just didn't work. So, but you figure it out. And that's the ability that we have to actually pass from one way of thinking to actually figure out a new method of going at it. And so, I wanted to read this because it's kind of it's the same idea that was presented before. It really shows the type of debate that we have today in terms of people discussing what we need in terms of government and this left and right battle, which is coming back every time. I just wanted to read this, and so that we could discuss it, and continue the discussion over it, because I think it's pretty very late. But I need two persons to read this dialogue. Who wants to read it?
Okay,
JP and Sasha.
voice card.
Huh?
Just before you start, that's from the Republic.
Oh, yeah.
The book from Plato.
So I'm Socrates, I guess. Well, my dear Adeimantus, what is the nature of tyranny? It's obvious, I suppose, that it arises.
Oh. That's Session.
Huh?
Oh, sorry. Okay. Okay, sorry.
Well,
I'll follow with you.
Well, my dear Adeimantus, what is the nature of tyranny? It's obvious, I suppose, that it arises out of democracy.
Yes.
Then, isn't it true?
Yeah, the easy
one. Isn't it true that tyranny arises out of democracy in the same sort of way that democracy arises out of oligarchy?
How do you mean?
The main objective of oligarchy, for the sake of which it was established, was, I think we agreed, wealth.
True. Wait, no, sorry, yes.
And its fall. And its fall was due to the excessive desire for wealth, which led to the neglect of all other considerations for the sake of making money.
True.
Then, does not democracy set itself an objective? And is not excessive desire for this its downfall?
And what is this objective?
Liberty, I said. You must have heard, it's said that this is the greatest merit of a democratic society, and that for that reason, it's the only society fit for men, for free men to live in.
It's certainly what they often say.
Then, as I was saying, an excessive desire for liberty, at the expense of everything else, is what undermines democracy and leads to the demand for tyranny. A democratic society in its thirst for liberty may fall under the influence of bad leaders who intoxicate it with excessive quantities of the need spirit. And then, unless the authorities are very mild and give it a lot of liberty, it will curse them for oligarchs and punish them.
This is just what a democracy does.
It goes on to abuse as servile and contemptible those who obey the authorities and reserves its approval, in private life as well as public, for rulers who behave like subjects and subjects who behave like rulers. In such a society, the principle of liberty is bound to go to extremes, is it not?
It certainly is.
What is more, I said, it will permeate private life and in the end infect even domestic animals with anarchy.
How do you mean?
Well, it becomes the thing for father and son to change roles, the father standing in awe of his son, and the son neither respecting nor fearing his parents, in order to assert what he calls his independence. And there is no distinction between citizen and alien and foreigner.
Yes, these things do happen.
They do, and there are other more trivial things. The teacher's fear and panders to his pupils, who in turn despise their teachers and attendants, and the young as a whole imitate their elders, argue with them and set themselves up against them, while their elders try to avoid the reputation of being disagreeable or strict by aping the young and mixing with them on terms of easy good fellowship.
All very true.
The extreme of popular liberty is reached in this kind of society when slaves, male and female, have the same liberty as their owners, not to mention the complete equality and liberty in the relations between the sexes.
That's how this whole story, while we're at it, has
Aeschylus
says.
Right, you shall. You would never believe, unless you had seen it for yourself, how much more liberty the domestic animals have in a democracy. The dog comes to resemble its mistress, as the proverb has it, and the same is true of the horses and donkeys as well. They are in the habit of walking about the street with a grand freedom and bump into people they meet if they don't get out of their way. Everything is full of this spirit of liberty.
You're telling me. I've often suffered from it on the
Our idea is kind of funny. Oh, no, that's not the end.
Okay.
Sorry.
What it all adds up to is this. You find that the minds of the citizens become so sensitive that the least vestige of restraint is resented as intolerable. Till finally, as you know, in their determination to have no master, they disregard all laws, written or unwritten.
Yes, I know.
Well, this is the root from which tyranny springs, a fine and vigorous beginning.
Indeed. But what happens next?
The same disease which afflicted and finally destroyed oligarchy afflicts democracy, in which it has more scope, still more virulently, and enslaves it. Indeed, any extreme is liable to produce a violent reaction. This is as true of the weather and plants and animals as of political societies.
What one would expect.
So from an extreme of liberty, one is likely to get, in the individual and in society, a reaction to an extreme of subjection.
Likely enough.
And if that is so, we should expect tyranny to result from democracy, the most savage subjection from an excess of liberty.
Hmm. Now, when they translate this, is it possible that the when he says words like liberty, that has like a much grander meaning, like we're talking about Greek that's thousands of years old, so obviously like a single word could have a much broader meaning.
I hope you will. That's too sure, but I think that's a fairly good translation. I think you can actually get at what he's.
People can misinterpret that.
Yes, well, yeah. Well, you'll have some people who actually try to actually tell what these guys were saying off the record, like in. You were there for Rob's class on the synarchy. So this question of Alan Bloom. Yeah, well, people. Whether they misinterpret willingly or not, but I don't think it's in the translation which they miss it. It's really in their way to actually look at the method of what Plato was saying. And obviously he's trying to figure out things. He's not saying this is what it is. Or usually he doesn't get to a conclusion. Actually tries to hypothesize what would be the best. And in the Republic, well, if you read it all, you see that he's trying to figure out on what kind of rules or what would be the best way of ruling a society. What is required from people? How do you have to educate them, your people, average citizen or your ruler? How does that work? What is the best? Music, geometry, all these things goes. He's talking about all of that. But I wanted to read this because I think it's, from as I heard, some people actually, it looks like it was written yesterday, in a sense. You know? And that's what's really interesting about Plato is that there's something universal, which is a human quest, which hasn't been resolved so far. There's been better system, and that's what we have to look at, really. Like in this question of the figuring out the doubling of the square. How we have to actually construct an hypothesis to get there. And what is what happens basically when you actually figure out that it's not by just doubling the length of the square, because if you only stay with that, you're never gonna make it. And you see that this debate, and I captured it as the idea of left and right, because they always play with the same parameter, They're saying, well, if we double this length, no, if we double the other length. And they're trying to go, you know, in the opposite way. But really, they're not changing the way they're thinking about the problem. So they'll never get there. But that's in the sense that's our fight right now. We have to figure out how we're gonna actually revive this method, which was used in the past and which was brought back with the Renaissance, to help actually human beings to really how would you say it? Well, to actually get to know what is a human being, in a sense. Like, really know how human being thinks, and what is the process of making a discovery. And that's really the idea that I want to show, and I wanted to finish with that quote by Lin, which is a really fairly short quote. But he kind of sums it up, in a sense. It comes from his Monad paper. He talks about, basically, the fight that we're in, and what is a human being, in a sense. And he says, the validity of our estimable knowledge of the nature of our universe is conditional upon the demonstration of the degree of man's willful power to change that universe. I thought that's a really excellent way of saying, you know, you actually don't know it until you do it. If you don't do it, well, then you'll probably never get there. It's clear. So the idea is, right now, we have a potential which is kind of sleeping. We have a population which says we have to wake up. And we know we can get there because we've experienced it. We've doubled the square. Now, how do you get somebody else to actually recognize he has this potential and to apply it? And that's where really we're going to be able to create that revolution that we were talking about. Not just campaign for, you know, look, my idea is nice, but really change the way that people are thinking about the relationship with, you know, other human beings and in the universe, what we can actually accomplish. Because that's what's required from us now. So, so we're gonna be back Saturday at 9. Whoever wants to come in at 9 on Saturday.